cause whoever you are, I hope your troubles are few. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I've been in love like you. You be brave, young lovers, and follow your star. Brave and faithful and true. And cling very close to each other tonight. I've been in love like you. And I know how it
feels. I'm Michael Ray Dresser, and you are listening to Thought-Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark.
You fly down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet, not by chance.
And each night we're going to bring you the best and the brightest authors and experts with solutions, the topics that you want to hear and the people who know to bring them to you. So let's do it together. Let's get to the heart of the issues that face us every day, right here, right now on Dresser After Dark, coast to coast and around the world on the BBS radio network.
You wing down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet, not by chance. Don't cry, young lovers, whatever you do. Say, don't cry because I'm alone. All of my memories are happy tonight. I have had a love of my own.
Singer-songwriter Angelica Milado is with us, and she's the author of Remember Who You Are, The Story Behind the Song. She's performed across Europe, Canada, and the U.S. Angelica, hi, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Michael. How are you?
Oh, I'm good, and thank you so much for being here. You know, you have an amazing story. You were brought up in communist Romania, forced to abandon your musical dreams, and you had a controlling former husband, and you were watching the Grammy Awards one night, and that's what did it. That's what lit that light bulb up, and you got determined to go after your dreams in North America. How easy was it to make that break, or was it a tough break to make to get over here?
Well, it was a very long journey, first of all. When I first came to Canada, I didn't even know how to speak English. Mm. So imagine, I felt almost as if I was born again in a totally different country, felt very much alien to everything that was going on here, the customs, the people, the language, absolutely everything, the school system, like down to the street and everything else. So I had to literally learn everything from scratch, which I did. It wasn't easy, as every immigrant can tell you, but
sure.
With will and determination, you can do anything in life. So,
oh, absolutely. Yeah. Angelica, we're talking, I don't even know if I want to say this, over 100 years ago, my grandfather was from Bucharest.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. You know,
I went to university to Bucharest.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Now, I wouldn't remember him, but I mean, he was from Bucharest. That's where, obviously, my father started out from. And he went from Bucharest to Russia to Turkey and then back. But when we look at the world, it seems to get very small once you get accustomed to where you are and the culture. What was the difference between living in Romania, communist Romania, and Canada?
Oh, where would I begin? It's entirely different, at least to the time when I left 15 years ago from Romania. Romania was different then than it is now. As you probably know, we had the revolution in 1989, and we are not communist anymore there. So the country is going through a humongous transition, and it's very different than even 15 years ago. So, but what I can tell you, up until the point when I left, everything was different. As I was saying before, the streets, the people, the language, the school systems. We had the food rationed in the communist regime. Women would wake up in the morning at 2-3 o'clock in the morning, trying to get milk for their children. Because otherwise they wouldn't. It was just a very limited amount of milk, for example, and you had to wake up really early in the morning to catch a liter or 2 liters of milk for your children. Again, everything was rationed. You couldn't talk freely outside about the president or anybody else in the government, or your parents would go missing. It was just a totally different world. We had, for example, bananas and oranges only at Christmas. We didn't have them throughout the whole year like they're here every day. So it's pretty different. Again, I'm not putting a negative on that, because
no.
That is obviously what shaped me into who I am today, and made me maybe made me even a bigger fighter and a person who dreams for bigger things. And I very much appreciate where I'm living right now. I remember when I first got my first car 10 years ago here in Canada, I was literally thanking God every day. I was driving on these roads, and I was saying, thank you, God, for these beautiful roads and this beautiful car. And, you know, it's just everything is different. And
I think the name of the book in and of itself, Remember Who You Are, that the women had a completely different position there than they do in Canada. Wasn't that the case?
Were women respected
the way they are in the United States and Canada? Did they have that same respect, or were women maybe pushed aside and pushed down?
Well, not as much. I don't think there's a big difference in that sense. Women were always respected there, and we were doing fine. Maybe the only thing that I would see a difference when it comes to women is that here, there is much more stress on women here. They have jobs 9 to 5 and sometimes second jobs, and then they have to take care of their children, do laundry and all these things, and they're much more stressed here. But other than that, I don't think there is a big difference in the way women were respected there. It was fine.
there was a question, because I didn't really know where to go with the base of that, because in different countries, we have the different cultures, and those different cultures obviously have different standards. But it's the remembering who you are. Deep down within us, there's usually that something that most people hide. And it's not so much remembering. Some people never know who they are. And when you can get to that who you are, that essence of you, then you can remember you've got something to tie to, and you become, there's that freedom that goes along with it when you get that sense of actually being.
Yes.
Now, in the go ahead.
Yes, no, in my book, Remember Who You Are, it refers mostly to the passion that every single one of us has inside. And we can be very much and feel very much fulfilled in life if we just find that passion that we have. Many people nowadays just get jobs because they know they have to be providers for their families, and they don't really have time to think of what they're really passionate about. So what my book and CD are about is trying at least to take baby steps and try to find what your passion is. And I'm not suggesting in any way that, you know, you should leave your job and get into what your passion is full-time. That's not always possible, but even if you started as a hobby, you will feel much better. I think you would, you know, feel much happier. And that's what I think, and I noticed with people around me, is that when you don't do what you love, it has many repercussions. It's not only that you're not happy during your job and then you come home and you're fine. It has a domino effect. You're not happy with your job. You wake up in the morning. Many don't feel like eating. Come home frustrated. They take it out on their spouse, or probably who probably doesn't do what he loves either. Now you have two people frustrated, yelling at their children. So, what's the example that the children will eventually follow that all this is normal? So that is my message in my book, that the best gift you can ever give to your children and to anybody is to support them and inspire them to follow what their passion is.
And I really believe when you talk about passion in and of itself, passion has to do with expression. And it's that deep down something that allows a person to express and be heard in their world. For you, it's singing. When you sing, everything inside of you comes out. And people that haven't found their passion, and it doesn't have to be within a job. They can keep the same job. You just said it. They keep the same job, the same way of life, But when they get that inner something that allows them to express, and more important, be safe in that expression, the world turns around.
Yes, that's very true.
Yeah, I think that's really where it is. Now, the book in and of itself, the book is your story, correct?
The book is actually what came first, before the music. I always loved writing. I always, even as a child, I used to just put my thoughts on paper. So after I came to Canada, you know, the new experiences and the challenges were like a pool of inspiration for me to write. So I kept writing. And my husband kept encouraging me, you should start writing music too. But I was not as confident to write music. So one day I just thought, why don't I just go through my, you know, my notes, my writings, my stories, and try to pull out the essence and turn it into lyrics. So that's what I did. That's how I did it. I turned the essence of each story into lyrics, and then the music just came to me. So once I was done with all the songs, I recorded the album, I decided to put all these stories into a book form, along with my biography, an epilogue, some more thoughts that I have about this passion that I'm talking about. And I put the book together with a CD, and so far it's been very well received.
You know, and on a much minor level, there's, you know, so many people, and I'm going to say, have gone through the same thing that you went through, and that's what they would recognize, not to the degree that you did coming to another country, not speaking the language. But at the same time, there are people get out into their own world and they get lost. And language doesn't necessarily have to be from a country. There's a cultural language, there's an emotional language, and there are people who don't speak a language that connect with other people. And I really believe in all the years that I've been doing interviews, and I've looked at the world through my eyes based on my own experiences. Music, in and of itself, there's a vibration in music. And there is a language in music, even if there isn't words to it. And music in and of itself is one of the things that allows a person to touch their soul. Most people can't get to it any other way, but music seems to be the vehicle to open that door to actually get there.
Yes. And I think the combination of the music and the words, so it's really up to every person what they feel that they resonate better with, music or words, or it can be anything. See, with my book, after living the experiences that I lived and seeing so many unhappy people, I decided to put this book together. And I'm not in any way suggesting that this book will solve your problems, everybody's problems, because it won't. But it can, through maybe one word or one little note in my CD, you know, just touch someone's heart in a way that they didn't expect and understand something that they heard it before better.
Yeah. So, now, by the way, from your press release, and you believe that everybody, really deep down there, everybody's a pure, passionate, and a loving spirit, and forever ready for it to unravel unlimited possibilities. It's that key. It's that one certain something for everybody, and it's different for everyone, to unlock that ability to do so. And if they recognize it, they can move with it. But most people go through their life, Angelica, and they don't recognize that doorway to move through, because they're frightened to death. If they do, somebody will think this, etc. But it's taking that step.
Yes, and it's not only that, Michael. You know what else? Many people look outside themselves and compare themselves with others. I'll give you an example. I was in Chapters here in Toronto for a book and CD signing, and this wonderful lady came to me and she said, you have such a beautiful voice. I wish I could sing like that. And I said, can you sing? She said, no, I can't at all. I wish I could. I said, okay. No, she said, I don't have any song in me. I said, what? How can you say that? Don't say that. You have a song in you. It's just waiting to come out, maybe in a different way. It doesn't have to come out through singing. So many people look outside, look at other people, and they say, oh, I wish I was, you know, on the cover of that magazine too, or I wish I was an actor like that too, or I wish I could sing like that or dance like that. And they fail to look inside and see what they're good at, because I truly, truly, honestly believe that every single person is good at something.
Angelica, they miss one thing. And they miss that when they look in the mirror that you're, there's only one you, and no matter how somebody can work with it, they can only be the second best you. You can only be the second best someone else. So your real job in life is to be absolutely the first best you. And I think you're absolutely right when we compare. The comparing, that you can't compare equally. So it's called go out, live your life, the best you can live your life. And when it's over with, you can look back and say, I did it for me, and I didn't have to compare myself with anybody. Angelique, we're just about out of time. Do you have a website? We can find the book and find and your music.
Yes, it's www.iamangelica.com. I have also a gift for the listeners, which is a free song download, my original song, You're My Reflection. Also, my CD and book are available for sale at Barnes & Noble throughout the United States. And again, it's called Remember Who You Are, The Story Behind the Song. And I will be soon touring in the United States at selected Barnes & Noble locations. Everything will be posted on my website.
Wonderful. Angelica, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you. Thank you, Michael. I really appreciate it.
Take care. Good night.
You too. Bye-bye. Bye.
Why should Spain and Tahiti and Rio just be only names to you and me? I feel certain there's people we'd be glad to know there. So tell me, why don't we get up and just go there? Go to those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London. Wonderful, fabulous places we're longing to see. There are so many simply incredible places to see. When I think of the warm Caribbean, I see a new world for you and me. I'd give anything just to have one single day there. And once we get there, I know that we'll stay there. Stay in those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London, Siam, Siena, Vienna, Verona, Java, Jamaica, Bombay.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Wang. You are listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Paula Kaplan with us. She is the author of When Johnny and Jane Come Marching Home, How All of Us Can Help the Veterans. She's a clinical and research psychologist, an affiliate at Harvard University's Du Bois Institute, and a fellow at the Women's Public Policy Program at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. She's the author of The Myth of Women's Masochism, They Say You're Crazy, How the World's Most Powerful Psychiatrists Decide Who's Normal, and 8 other books. Paula, hi, welcome to the show.
Hi, glad to be with you.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. I am ecstatic that you have a book, and as a matter of fact, the book in and of itself covers the topic. Just the title itself, When Johnny and Jane Come Marching Home, How All of Us Can Help Veterans. There are veterans that come back today with post-traumatic stress. There are veterans that come back, and their life as they knew it is over with. There's some of them that end up on the street. There's some of them that end up with crime and so on and so forth. Something is wrong with this picture, and it needs to be addressed.
Yes, absolutely. The problem has been going on for a long time. In fact, veterans from every war have suffered horribly because war is traumatic. But in earlier wars, we have been I think less aware of the kinds of problems that veterans came back with, and so it was more kept under the rug. It doesn't mean they didn't suffer. They suffered horribly. But what's happening now, Even the press releases from the military and from the Veterans Affairs people, the top brass are expressing great concern about the fact that they bring in program after program after program to try to help veterans, and the suicide rates keep going up. Hospitalizations for this emotional anguish and suffering keeps going up. As you said, homelessness, imprisonment, family breakdown. They are so isolated. That's the really the core problem. It's not the only one, but it's bad enough to have been through the horrors of war. But when you come home and you are so isolated from the community, that makes everything worse. People have wondered why the effects of war trauma sometimes don't show up very intensely until sometime after the person gets home, and it's often because of the cumulative effect of their isolation. Part of the reason that they're so isolated, and this is one of my concerns, is that although people mean well when they invented the term post-traumatic stress disorder and when they apply it, it's a mental disorder. And I tell you, when the veterans I've interviewed from every war when they've described to me what they've been through, I would be amazed if most Americans wouldn't say, you know what, if I'd been through that, I would have trouble sleeping. I would feel anguish. I'd be having moral conflicts. I would be experiencing grief and fear and all these devastating kinds of emotions. Therapists are not trained to deal with that kind of thing any better than ordinary lay people are. And when we say you're traumatized by war, that means you're mentally ill with PTSD, we don't help. We just make it worse. We add to their burdens because they feel like, oh, that means I should be coping better.
Paula, when we take a look at it, do you take the average kid on the street, male, female, and they've gone through whatever they've gone through. They've gone through the culture. They've gone through society. Now they go into a situation where there's combat once they've joined. How do you explain to someone what it's like coming off the street, quote unquote, and getting into a combat situation? Now you're trained that you're going to have to kill someone or be killed, quote unquote. The world is completely different. There is a complete different culture within that military operation. Years ago, you know, and I knock on wood, when I was in the service, I was too young for Korea and Nam hadn't come around yet. So I didn't see combat. But in those days, one of the things that I saw that was different from what's going on today, I was in the Marine Corps. I'm a former Marine. And when we were taught in boot camp, you got out of line, you got knocked on your rear end. I mean, there was no playing with this thing, not like today. Now, the Army, from what I understand, through the past, I don't know, 8, 10, 12, 15 years, something like that, and I'm not sure if they do it today, they used to have a timeout card. That if the pressure got too much, they'd show the card, and the drill instructors had to back off of them. That in and of itself, I think, was the worst thing that could have happened. They're going to go out there, and they're not going to, if they're going to get stressed, there's nobody to turn around and say, I can't deal with this anymore. So going into a situation like that, there are people who obviously get trained for it, but there's no way to tell anybody what it's like, and you can't tell me what it's like because I haven't been there. So where I would relate to it. Those are very special moments deep down within someone. And I think just like Alcoholics Anonymous, it takes somebody who's been there, done that, and recovering to be able to work with them. It would seem as though it would take someone who had been in combat that understands what can happen, what the effect is mentally, emotionally, intellectually, and then be able to work with someone. Because someone is a psychiatrist, psychologist, does not mean that they have the ability to touch that person where they need to be touched.
Yeah, okay, you made a bunch of good points. Let me say a couple of things real quickly.
Please.
One is that people from all wars that still have living veterans I have spoken with, however the military has changed or different branches of it may have changed in various ways, people from all wars have said to me, there is no way you can really be prepared, no matter how much, if all of past generations in your family were in the military, if you played with toy soldiers, if you couldn't wait to get out there and kill the enemy, there is nothing that can prepare you for what's really going to happen. And so, and one veteran after another, every single one I talked to has told me that. And so there always is a shock to some extent, a loss of innocence. And then what you certainly don't get trained for, you're certainly given target practice in killing other people, but not in dealing with seeing your friend get blown in half by an IED. How can anything prepare you for that either?
Nothing.
And so you're right that it's vets will tell you, I want to talk to other vets because I know they'll get it because they've been there. And that's so important, and I'm not questioning that at all. But what I'm saying is, unless we want vets only to spend their time with other vets, and their family members probably aren't vets, their children certainly aren't, all their friends have not been vets before they went into the military, we need to bring them back into the wider community as well. They have to get jobs. They have to deal with people outside military contexts. And for that reason, I think, and because 99% of Americans have never been in the military, we are a nation of war illiterates. We don't know what war is. And so for the veterans' sake, to help break down their isolation, and for the sake of this country, of civilians needing to learn what are the people, other people in this country having to go through, we need to have a national project of having every civilian interview a vet. Now, your point about only somebody else who's been there can really understand it, to a certain extent, sure. But can I tell you just a really brief example of something that I think everybody can relate to? There was a vet from the war in Iraq who is gung-ho war in general and still thinks we were right to go to war in Iraq, we were liberating the people of Iraq, and he'd go back in a second if he weren't horrifically physically injured. But here's what he said to me, in spite of all of that. He said, every night I hear a woman screaming in my head. Who is that woman? Well, he said there was a woman in Iraq, and she was close to us, and physically close to us at one point, and we thought she had dynamite and was going to try and blow us up. And so I shot her and killed her. I said, you killed her? Weren't other people firing? No, I was the only one who fired. I killed her, and I still hear her screams every night. And I thought he was then going to tell me, because we found out it wasn't dynamite or she wasn't going to try and hurt us. He said, no, we found out it was dynamite, and yes, she was going to blow us up. And I said, then why do you hear her screams every night? And he said, because I wasn't raised to kill. I was raised to cherish life.
Sure.
Nobody was raised to kill. And so that's the kind of thing that I think every civilian, if you hear it, you catch your breath. Tears come to your eyes. And so there are ways that on a very human level, any untrained person can just listen to these stories. And what we need to be doing is listening for opportunities to say, you know what, if I'd been through that, I would be reacting the way you are. I don't think you're mentally ill, and I don't think you're crazy. And vets have told me repeatedly that's in some ways the most important thing that anybody can say to them. And another thing is to look for ways to bring them back into connection, first with you and then with the wider community. There are lots of cultures where the whole community takes responsibility for helping someone who was traumatized come back into the wider community.
So I think one of the problems that we face is with the vets is the lack of support. You know, go back to Nam when the kids were being spit on so on and so forth. There is that lack of support, and also, as you're saying, it was the lack of understanding. This is what I would love to see. Paula, it will never happen, but this is what I would love to see. If you're going to get into the military, that before you signed the dotted line, before you joined, you went through a training program, and the training program said, this is what you're going to come up against, and see that friend of yours being torn in half. Experience the story of the man shooting the woman and so on and so forth. If you can move through that and realize that that can come up, then join. If you know you can't deal with it ahead of time, don't join. Here's the problem. I don't like war. I don't think anybody likes war, and I don't think anybody really likes killing. Life should be cherished. I am totally with him, and I'm totally on your side of the table with the vets. But at the same time, there are people out there that want to hurt us, and there are people out there that want to take our country away and everything that we stand for. So there's got to be a military. So there's got to be that some kind of a balance, that homeostasis that we can move to be able to deal with this for the most part before it happens. And when those kids come back, 5,000%, 1,000,000% support, and you're absolutely right. What would I tell somebody what I would do in a situation like that if I've never been in it? That's not what they need to hear.
Yeah.
I'm with you.
Well, and I think that, yeah, the more you can try to prepare somebody for what's really going to happen, then, yeah, that's just on compassionate grounds. I mean, sure, we all need to be prepared if we're going to go through horrible experiences. But, you know, I'm trying to think, how do you really fully prepare somebody? You can't blow up their friend in front of them as part of the training. You can say, imagine it vividly. We'll help you do these imagining exercises. You can show them pictures of what somebody looks like when they're blown up. But as one vet said to me, he said, when there were 25 of us who had breathed together for months when they were in a combat zone, and he said, there was an IED that exploded as we were coming toward it, and he said, and I saw my driver's blood and brains hit the windshield. Now, you know, in training, no matter what you do, it's sort of like going to a movie. You see people killed and it's horrible, but you know it's not really happening. And so I'm not sure how well they can be prepared. But what we know we can do, what we can do is to be compassionate when they get back. And I'll tell you, I've had people, civilians, doing these interviews. I have had people who are fervent peace movement activists, have been all their adult lives, and they have no problem interviewing even a vet who is the most supportive of war, because that's not the point. The point is, this is a human being. It's a human being who has suffered. It's a human being who deserves to be brought back into the community. And what I've suggested, there's a whole chapter in my book that's for lay people who want to do this, because one of my worries is that we are such a psychiatrized country. I'll overhear people, I'm sure you've heard the same thing. Somebody will say, well, you know, her boyfriend dumped her and she was really upset, but I didn't talk to her because I'm not a therapist, so I wouldn't know what to say. And I want to say, whatever happened to friendship? Whatever happened to ordinary human connection? There is a wealth of evidence that heals, that support and connection heal. You don't have to be a therapist. But in chapter 6, I talk about how from step 1, finding a vet to interview, and then how you start out the conversation by saying, as an American, I take some responsibility for my government having sent you to war, and so I consider it my responsibility to listen to whatever you want to tell me for as long as you listen, and I am not here to judge. I'm just here to listen and to understand. And then there's a whole list of questions that you can ask, kinds of problems to watch out for, and you know, some things not to say, and then kinds of issues that can come up and some ways to deal with them. And it's just amazing when you start hearing the human stories. Politics just do not matter. In fact, I wrote about this. I have a blog on Psychology Today, and I wrote about this in one of my essays, and I said, every time I interviewed a vet, it didn't matter if our personalities were similar or different, if our politics were similar or different, I always ended up feeling that was sacred time when I was in that room with them. And I thought, sacred? That's funny. I wouldn't have expected that word to come to mind. Why sacred? And then I realized, because every one of them was so truthful and so open, and they trusted me, even if they had reason to be mistrustful or scared of what I might think, at the beginning, they trusted me to give it a try, to see how I responded, and they were talking, it was sacred too, because they were talking about both the most horrific things that could happen to human beings and about the most tender, sensitive things. When I came home, my family didn't seem to understand that I felt different, or they wanted me to go back to being the cheery guy I always was, or the nurturing woman that I always was. And so sacred because they're talking about the things that matter most in life, the most painful and the most potentially beautiful. And so this work is tremendously important and profoundly meaningful. And it works. Veterans were saying to me that when a civilian would interview them, or they'd go speak to a high school or a college class, and somebody would say something a little bit kind to them, that they'd go home and they'd sleep that night for the first time since Vietnam or since Iraq.
I see another problem here also. And by the way, most of this is learned response, not from the vet, but from those people on the outside. What causes us to move towards a particular group is acceptance. And through that acceptance, we find something called identity. Now you got these kids that have an identity. They've gone to school, they've done this, they have their family. They go to war, they have identity and acceptance through the other military. Now they come back. And the identity, because the person who they are now is not who left, and their identity is gone, the acceptance is something, and if they don't have that, they get pushed back, they get closed off, and I think that's where a lot of the problems start. It's the lack of support and the lack of the ability to say, this is who I am, and this is how I fit in. It's that integration coming back into the family. One of the things that stops it, and I think there's a major problem, I happen to be just slightly right to center. There's things I believe in both sides. So I'm kind of a middle of the roader when it comes to it. And I remember when Bush got elected that second time, there was a kid, she's probably 20 some odd years old. She was at the local university where I was living at the time, and she had helped me do some packing and moving. And I saw her and she's very extremely progressive. And I saw her in the market right after Bush won. I said, look who won. And the kid turned around and looked at me in all sincerity, and she said, are you a baby killer? And I looked at her and I said, of course, what else am I? What am I going to do, fight with it? But the point is, it's that non-support, that identity that they've missed, and those other thoughts that cause people to look down on them for what they've done. And what they've done is they've protected you and I.
Well, that's what's so interesting to me, is that I wouldn't want that young woman to be interviewing one of the vets.
No.
Absolutely not, because part of the essence of these interviews is not to judge. You can go away and think whatever you want about the politics of it, but the point is to hear the human story. And I would venture to say that if we could have her not interview a vet, but watch a videotape of somebody else interviewing a vet, and hearing how what did they do in a war, and how did they feel about it? I've never heard anybody say. I'm sure they're out there, but it's just very rare that vets actually feel like, oh yeah, I killed somebody and it was great, and that's all there is to it. It's that simple. A lot of them will say, well, they were the enemy, so I had to do it. But do I like knowing that I killed people? No. Do I like knowing that I killed civilians? No. And so the point is, for the more that we get over this illiteracy about war that we have as a nation, the less likely people are to oversimplify by just saying, well, that's a baby killer. And you're right about the identity thing. There's a culture clash. There's a huge culture clash. I've thought about how when I've taught in universities, and some of my students have gone to Nepal or to Argentina for junior year, and they've come back, and even if they had a great time when they were abroad, and they come back to the same friends they had before, they feel they are so changed because of having been immersed in a different culture. And their friends think they're exactly like they were before. And some of them are just terribly anguished because of this. Now, this is pertinent to what you said about identity. If you imagine that instead of going to Argentina for a fun junior year, where you've gone is to Iraq or Afghanistan, and you've been in combat, and leading up to that, there was all the military training. You follow orders, you give orders, you fit within a hierarchy. You are supposed to be trained to aim for the goals of defending or attacking or killing. Now you come home, you look the same, you got shorter hair probably, but you are so different, because what could be a more tremendous change in cultures than to go from the military culture, and this is whatever you think about war, whatever you think about the military, it's really easy to see. These are vastly different cultures. You come home, you want to be giving orders or following orders all the time. What's that going to do for your family life? How are your friends going to react? And the hair trigger responses to deal with things by attacking or defending, that's not how you get along with people. That's not how you function in the workplace.
Well, let me hold you up, because we're running out of time, and I want to make a point here, because I'm listening very closely to you.
About this culture clash, the less these vets are going to have to feel like, nobody knows who I am. We all need to learn what they're struggling with.
No question. Paul, we're running out of time, but the one thing that's staying with me as I'm listening to you very closely, I want to take you back to the young woman who said to me, are you a baby killer? That's a learned response. And the reason for the comment is very simple if you think about it. She came from the university, and in essence, she was getting acceptance for that mindset. And in that mindset, she found identity. And what we are dealing with are learned responses. My feeling is if you've learned it, you can unlearn and you can relearn. And I love what you're doing. We will back you up 1,000%. And if you would come back occasionally, let us know what's going on and anything we can do to help. I'm on your team.
Sure. Do we have a second where I can give the website?
Oh, absolutely. I was going to ask for that.
Okay, thank you. We've just started a fund. This is a charitable fund. It's through the Foundation for Excellence in Mental Health Care. It's about health, not mental illness. And the fund is called the Welcome Johnny and Jane Home Fund. And what we are going to be doing, people can send in donations, but what the money will be used for is if individuals or even small community groups want to set up in their area a civilians interview veterans program. It's so simple to do. We're going to be making a video and making it available online for free. And then if somebody wants to get a little bit of money to help somebody deal with the paperwork or the organization or rent a space where the interviews can happen, they can apply to the fund for that. My website, where you can find information about that and other information about the book, and I write blogs there as well, is When Johnny and Jane Come Marching .weebly.com. Or you can also reach me if you go to Paula J. Kaplan, Kaplan with a C, on the Psychology Today website. You can reach
Wonderful.
Me through there. There's a contact form. So thank you so much for doing this. I really hope that for Memorial Day, everybody will try to find a vet and listen to their story and help educate other people.
Hey, by the way, Paula J. Kaplan with a C, go get them. I think you're doing a wonderful job.
Thank you so much. Thank you for letting us talk about this.
Take care. Good night.
Good night. And the only heart I own for you and you alone. Well, that's all. That's all. I can only give you country walks in springtime, and a hand to hold when leaves begin to fall, and a love whose burning light will warm the winter night. That's all. That's all. There are those, I am sure, who have told you they would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you adore, for now and evermore. That's all. That's all. Da da da.
All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm after in return, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you adore.
I'm Michael Ray Dresser. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark.
That's all.
Attorney, commercial pilot, business strategist, motivational speaker, Carney Madison was with us. Wears many hats. His expertise has made him a much sought after public speaker in his native country of South Africa, both at business forums and university lecture halls. His memoir is the key word, is entitled The Final Audit, and let us say hi, welcome to the show, Carney.
Hi, Michael, and thank you so much for inviting me.
Oh, and thank you for being here. What an interesting ride this must have been with the ups and downs. Caught between the KGB and the Mossad. Let's go back to, when you were flying and you flew the covert missions around the world, and at what point you... The impetus for the story got triggered. Where was that where you realized that you had to create a memoir to leave a legacy because it had to do with something with your family that was stolen?
The final audit really is something of a thought-provoking tale where I attempt to explain my existence to my children. Now, we're all products of our experiences. My experiences have been particularly unusual, and as a result, I was motivated and inspired to do many things that perhaps other people wouldn't do. I grew up in poverty. I grew up in a caravan on the streets of Johannesburg and became aware of the fact that my ancestors came from Norway. My great uncle had been murdered by the Nazis. Although my grandfather was nothing more than a poor fisherman, he had a relatively well-educated a brother whom little was known of. And I felt as time went by that because I'd grown up alone, I'd lived in a caravan, I had no boundaries in terms of how I lived and where I lived and what I did, it became almost an obsession to find out where did I come from and what was it that made me turn out to be so different to all my friends. Today I have an 11-year-old and a 14-year-old daughter, and they love me very much, but constantly their friends are saying to them, you know, your father is he's a lovely guy, he's such an eccentric fellow, but why is he so different? And I felt that by writing of the experiences, it would enrich their lives, provide some sort of a roadmap as to where they might go. And of course, my own life has been very much a combination of a spy thriller, rising to the challenges of life, coming from adverse circumstances, learning how to deal with them. And the net result is that from what readers write into me, they see the book as something of a self-help book that offers them thoughts on how to deal with circumstances in their life. I just recently received a letter from a doctor who tells me he's read the book three times, and he's now given it as a present to his son, who recently qualified as an actuary, and with the inscription, I do hope you'll find in this book the lessons in life that I should have taught you.
Carney, let me hold you up, because I think that when we get to the lessons of life and the paths that we take in life, it usually starts out with a certain something. With you, really, it started out with that cache of artwork that had been stolen from your family during the Second World War. And it was the dealing with the KGB and the Mossad. I mean, that in and of itself must have been, that must have had to take every piece of strength that you had to be able to deal with those two units.
Yes, I in fact inadvertently became involved with them. What happened was, during the previous white government in South Africa, prior to 1994, I was moonlighting as a commercial helicopter pilot and a commercial jet pilot for the police, for national intelligence, and the Secret Service in South Africa. And one day, the brigadier said to me, I think I was the only Jewish pilot at the time, And he said to me, you know, South Africa is under tremendous pressure because of sanctions that have been imposed by other countries. And would you be interested in assisting the country in sanction busting? South Africa was very, very involved in busting sanctions because the economic survival of the country very much depended on that. And I agreed to do it. And not really knowing what I was agreeing to. And he said to me one day, take two photographs. And he gave me an address in a suburb on the outskirts of Johannesburg. And he said, take your two photographs. I arrived there, Michael, and much to my dismay, it was a retail paint shop, you know, very much like a hardware store. And I walked in and gave my name. And a fellow arrived. He said his name is Moshe. Would I sit down? And with nothing more than a cryptic comment, he said to me, have you been to Lisbon, Paris, London, and various other countries? I said, yes. He said, come back and see me in 7 days. I can't honestly say I knew quite what he was getting at. But 7 days later, I arrived. He handed me a passport issued by a foreign country, with stamps in it showing entries and exits into these various cities that I've just mentioned, a letter from the Department of Foreign Affairs explaining that I could use two passports in South Africa in those days. It was a criminal offense to carry a second passport. And here I had government authorization to use the second passport, telling us when, telling me where I grew up, where I went to school. It was a passport from the Kingdom of Swaziland, which, as you know, is a separate country. And I had 24 hours in which to memorize my new biography. And we were also told in no uncertain terms we would be doing the flying. But if anything went wrong, we were to leave the country on South African passports. We would land in a neighboring country. Very little would be told of where we are flying. We would only, our flight plans would be filed for us, and only an hour before takeoff would we, on a strictly need-to-know basis, know where we were flying. Now, a lot of it wasn't really terribly ominous. A lot of it was flying businessmen to various countries where they were able to negotiate import and exportation of goods. But also remember that the current government of South Africa, which is the African National Congress, the ANC, was a terrorist organization in those days. And it's probably common knowledge that Nelson Mandela spent 27 years in jail. How his causes were noble, but he admitted that he was a terrorist. And in fact, we even have a police commissioner today who was honored for his role as a member of the ANC terrorist branch. He managed to blow up a number of people in a bar called the Magoob Bar bombing, and as a result of that, he was made police commissioner. So you can imagine the kind of conflicting interests. Now, through flying, we used to leave South Africa. We would land with a South African registration in a neighboring country. We were then told to take all the decals off the machines. We then put foreign registrations. We buried our South African passports, took out our foreign passports, and then we continued on our missions. Now, these missions also involved positioning intelligence officers in neighboring countries, because the ANC was launching attacks not only on strategic installations like power lines and electricity supplies and telecommunications, but they were physically blowing up people and killing people. So it wasn't very difficult to be persuaded that it can only assist in the security of the country by dropping off various security personnel beyond our borders. And then I was asked by this same Moshe one day, he was curious, why are you willing to do this kind of flying? Now, at no stage did he give me a calling card, say, by the way, I'm from Mossad. But it became quite obvious one day when I went to the paint shop to get my passport renewed, and I followed him into the back. There were massive containers. And I said to him, but what on earth is this? This can't be paint. There's enough here to supply the whole of Africa. And lo and behold, they were full of armaments. Now, Mossad, during that period, assisted the South African government in many ways. They facilitated the sanction busting. They facilitated many produce and a lot of technology coming into South Africa. Indeed, the very basis of the South African armaments industry had its intellectual capital, the roots of its intellectual capital, was the Israeli aircraft industries. So that was a liaison that was basic to South Africa's survival. Then I realized that I could try to leverage the resources of Mossad and find out if they might have a lead on where I might find a particular Nazi with a particular cachet of looted art. And then years went by, and other than having a very limited relationship with these players, one day I received a note from him that he wished to see me. And he said to me, if you're still interested in finding the art, be in Lisbon on the 18th of the month. And that was it. And I knew that I had to be there. I jumped on an aeroplane and I went to Lisbon. He gave me the name of a hotel that I had to be. And
wait, Carney, let me hold you up right there. Let me hold you up right there, because we have to stay. We're running out of time, but most important, this is where you want to leave it. Now, everybody's got to find out what happened. And the only way to find out what happened, you got to buy the book.
Right, certainly. Well, we could sum it up if you like. I could perhaps tell them why I think the book might appeal to readers.
Sure, go ahead.
Sum up. Well, I think the final audit offers lessons in life that fall outside of conventional textbook teachings. I think the reader will find a wisdom born out of conflicting and diverse human experiences. It is a fast-moving, action-packed, real-life adventure involving the pursuit of stolen in collaboration with a Mossad agent and an encounter with a beautiful KGB double agent. Time is precious to all of us, and the time spent reading this book will enrich the soul and advance the reader's knowledge of post-World War II contemporary history. The author's philosophy and beliefs on how to turn adverse circumstances in one's life into opportunities for self-development will empower the reader to transform negative experiences into positive actions. And so many of my readers have written to advise me that they constantly draw strength and inspiration from the events described in the final audit.
And I hear every bit of that. Okay, website we can find you at and the book.
Right. The website is one word, thefinalaudit.com by Carney Matison, CarneyMatison. So it's either The Final Audit by Carney Matison. You can get it from Barnes & Noble, Kindle, Amazon, all of those. But the website really explains what it's about with an audiovisual, thefinalaudit.com. And if anyone wants to contact me, my email is Carney Matison, again, CarneyMatison, @gmail.com.
Hey, Carney, thank you so much for joining. That was great. That should be a movie.
In fact, I have just finished writing the movie script and am negotiating currently.
Go get him. Hey, thanks for being with us. Good night.
Good night. Thank you. And a love whose burning light will warm the winter night. That's all. That's all. There are those, I am sure, who have told you they would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you adore, from now and evermore. Oh, that's all. Oh, that's all. Know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you adore.
Yeah, it's me that you'll adore. For now and evermore. That's all.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray Dresser. You're listening to Thought-Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Bob Baer with us, founder and chairman of the SEGR Enterprises, whose divisions include internet traffic generation, website monetization, a publishing company, and most recently, film documentary production. He's an in-demand speaker and a business coach. The latest book is Launch, and it releases, is that this year or is that last year, Bob? When is Launch coming out?
The printed version will be out in September, but we are taking pre-launch orders and getting ready to release the electronic version, and which would include the printed version as soon as it's printed.
Wonderful, because Launch is harness your passion and fuel your destiny. There's so many people today that have been, Bob, they've been forced to be entrepreneurs. It's not something where they decided that's what they were going to be. Forced into it, i.e. a lot of outsourcing, a lot of business closing, a lot of competition that caused them to be out on their own. And there they were sitting down in front of their computer at their desk at home, and now they're in business. And the internet, the social media has leveled the playing field for so many people. But just because you have the ability to do it doesn't mean you know what to do. And I think that in and of itself is critical. So let's start it this way. I've decided that I'm going to be an entrepreneur now. I've got a business, and it's dependent upon the internet. What's the first thing that I look at? What do I ask myself? What do I search first?
The first thing I would look at, you know, a lot of people come up with an idea, a great idea for a product or a service, and they just go with it without checking out if it makes any sense, about checking out if there's a demand for it. And I can tell you one place not to check, and that is you normally don't get real good advice from your family and friends. They're not very objective.
No question about it. You got to go to the professional, don't you?
Yeah, but actually with the internet, there are some ways to do a lot of research that's free and really helps you. There are, for example, if you just go to Amazon.com and type in the subject that you're interested in, you can find out what type of books come out on top with that query, and you can find out what other people buy that buy books like that. You can do a lot of research just on Amazon.
But one of the things that you have to, quote unquote, ask yourself, there are certain questions that you have to ask yourself before you even do this. Most people don't even know what to ask because they say, I'm going to go into business. They don't know what to do. What are some of the things that I should look at before I actually take that step and go into business? Are there things I should really take a look at myself in the mirror and say, well, is this what you want? What should we ask?
One of the things to ask yourself is what your motivation is. You know, obviously, a lot of people have the motivation, well, I want to make money. Sometimes when you start your own business, it really sounds great. It really sounds wonderful. I'm going to have all this freedom. I'm going to have all this money. And people don't realize what all it takes. They don't realize the skill it takes to go into business. And so they have to ask themselves, do I really have what it takes? Do I have the initiative? Am I a self-starter? Am I innovative? Can I come up with new ideas? Do I have sales skills? Do I have negotiating skills? Can I communicate well with people? And one thing to think about is the fact that there's a lot of those lists of things that you should have. You don't really have to have all of it yourself. You have to look for what areas you're strong in, concentrate on your areas of strength, and the areas that you're weak in, find somebody else, team up with somebody. Bring on somebody to help you or hire somebody to help you to replace the areas you're weak in.
Now, by the way, there are so many people who have brilliant ideas, and there's no question about it. And when you're dealing with being in business, you've got to have something called credibility. There's a lot of scams out there. There's a lot of people who will take advantage of you. How do you create that instant credibility if you're going to be in a business?
Well, couple of ways. One is to really, and this sounds really simple, but really learn to be an active listener. when somebody is asking you questions, wanting to talk to you, listen to what they're saying first. So many people just start talking and giving what they want to say. But if you want to build quick credibility, one of the best ways is to get an endorsement from someone. Find a strategic partner that everybody already knows well and work out an arrangement with them so that they find out about you, they try out your product or read your book, and they endorse you. And another thing that you can do on the Internet a lot quicker and faster than you can in other ways is you can basically create your own niche of being an expert in your niche. I mean, I know people that have done pretty well creating a niche as an expert on hamsters. And the way that you show yourself as an expert is you provide education to people. You teach them. You offer free reports. You do radio interviews. You write a book.
Now, by the way, one of the things that plague people when they're going into business, you can get motivated and you're there, you're ready, and you're doing everything you can possibly do, but it's that stay motivated. There are those times when, well, maybe we don't want to get out of bed today, or we don't want to do this. How do you get someone to stay motivated, to stay focused? Because if they're not on track, they're going to lose everything that they started.
Yeah. One. I think it's really important from the very beginning to decide what your vision is. What's the end result you want? And keep your focus on that end result. There's a lot of battles. There's a lot of struggles. There's a lot of discouraging things that happen in business. And you really have to stay focused on the long term and realize that even when you've had a bad day, as long as you were focused and doing things to achieve what your vision was, if it's bringing you closer, that's a good day.
Now, when we're looking at these things, and I've seen this happen with many people over the years, you get somebody who has a great idea. Then they decide to go into business, and they do go into business, and things start to happen. Well, they get to a point where sales go beyond their ability to handle it all themselves. It's finding the right personnel, the right people to be to work with you. I found over the years that if you're going to hire somebody, find somebody who knows more than you do about whatever it is you're hiring them about. But there is something that stops a lot of businesses because of the ego of that business owner that has to be the one that knows everything. And that in and of itself is a great, great killer of businesses. So how do you find the right personnel and allow them to do what they do?
You're right in the way that people kill their business by insisting on doing everything themselves. And as it grows, you start out a new business owner, a new entrepreneur, starts out with certain things he's really good at, really enthused about, and after your business grows, you outgrow your own abilities, and you get to the place where you really need to let somebody else lead in certain areas. There's really three different areas in any business that kind of like the three legs in a stool. If you don't have all three of them, the business is not going to be very secure. It's going to topple. The first one is you have to have someone that has vision. You have to have the person with the fire in their belly and the goals. But you also need somebody that's good in marketing and sales. And then eventually, as you grow, you have to have somebody that's good in fulfillment and administration. And I've never seen one person with all three of those assets. Usually the person that starts the business is the visionary, and they do okay at marketing and sales in their own area, but they don't know how to carry it out farther. But a lot of times people get messed up in not being strong in administrative skills. And you really need to partner up with someone. And most people look at resumes, and what I have found is that you can really go wrong in just relying on a resume. Anybody can say whatever they want on a resume. It's more important whoever you're hiring, whatever your team member is. It's really important what their personality is, what their temperament is. You don't want an accountant, dry, analytical person as your receptionist. You want a people person. You want somebody that's friendly and warm and welcoming to people. But you don't want that warm, friendly person to be your accountant. So I really look closely at temperaments and personality traits and what someone's passion is. I've also found that when someone is really passionate about what they're doing, they really like their job, they're really productive. But when you take someone and you fit them into a job just because that's what their education is, but they're not really passionate about it, you never get a whole lot of success with them until you find where they fit in.
One of the big problems that people run into, and it's the constant, there is something no matter what goes on with personalities in the business, who's going to administrate, who's going to sell, who's going to whatever. The most important thing that they have to think about in the very beginning, it's something called money, capitalization. Where do you find money in this kind of an economy? If you're really starting to get there, you've got everything that it takes, you've got the magic, you're moving forward, but it's going to take money to stay consistent. Where do you find it today?
Well, there's one advantage in this economy, being a poor economy. There are a lot of people that used to have their money invested in the stock market or invested in real estate, and there are plenty of people that have pulled their money out of those traditional investments because they're really afraid of losing even more. There's a lot of money sitting on the sidelines, and it's not too difficult sometimes to find someone who's willing to partner with you to come up with some money because they believe in what you're doing. That takes personal networking. That takes getting to know people, whether it's going to the Rotary Club or whether it's networking with other business people. But there really is money to help fund you if you meet someone that has it sitting there and they're willing to do a joint venture with you, but they get to share in the profits that way. There are some other ways to fund your growth when you start out. One of those ways is by finding, I'll call it cross distribution. You may have a product that on its own, you're selling some here and there, but look for people that sell complementary things. If you're in the hearing aid business, look for someone in the eyeglass business or a medical professional. Find people that you can work with that even sometimes the competition. I was talking last week to a man in a factoring company. He provides financing, but he provides the factoring, the financing for people in the trucking and shipping industry. He doesn't do it for doctors and dentists, which is also a really big business. But what he's done is he's worked out with other people, his competitors, and when he gets someone inquiring about factoring and raising money that's a doctor, he knows exactly who he's going to send them to. And when that person that he sends people to runs into someone in the trucking industry, they send it to him. So one of the ways to leverage yourself is to try to find other partners, other strategic partners that can work with you, and they become your marketing agent instead of you having to do all of it.
So you do strategic networking. You get people in like businesses, then you combine it together, and then you're referring back and forth within that circle.
Right, right.
Okay.
You can even do that with your employees sometimes. A lot of people don't realize when they have a number of employees that they can make great salespeople if they're just given the opportunity.
No, but by the way, there is there's that old, what is it, that's 6 degrees of separation. There was a time years ago that if you knew somebody who knew somebody who knew somebody, if you ran into 10, 15, 25, 30, 50 people, that was about as far as you were going to go. Today, if you use it properly, if you use social networking properly, you open yourself to hundreds of millions of people. And if you just capture a, 100th of 1% of all that, you're making a lot of money. But it's getting that uniqueness about you, understanding what it is about your product, your service, your cause, whatever the case may be, that people will listen to. And it's got to be just a little bit different than everybody else, because we are in such a competitive marketplace today, not like it was. A great example, go out and look for a job today. There used to be 10 or 15 people that they would have to look at and interview that were applying for the job. Now you got 10,000 for the same job.
Yeah.
So it's knowing all this and being competitive and finding your own brand, and I think that's so critical why they'll come to you as opposed to someone else.
Yeah, that's right. And it also, another thing that helps, whether you're looking for a job or looking for a customer, is to step out of your own shoes and look through their eyes. What are they looking for? What are their needs? What are their wants? And instead of trying just to sell them on what you're offering, you find out what they're looking for, and you find a way to link what you're offering to help satisfy what they're looking for.
And by the way, I picked the book up. I read it page by page, cover to cover, launch, when it comes out. What's my takeaway? We're starting to run out of time now, Bob, but what's my takeaway? What do I, Michael Ray, get that I did not have before I picked that book up?
You know, I've been starting businesses ever since I was a teenager. It's just what I love to do. And like most new business owners when I was young, I made some mistakes. And it's taken me, what would it be, you know, 40-some years of learning. And I just believe that by reading some good advice and finding out in order what the steps should be and what to look for, that someone can save themselves years and years of heartache and, you know, find a shortcut to success instead of having to go through the school of hard knocks.
Oh, I hear that one loud and clear. So the ability to anticipate it before it happens. Know where those traps are before you step into it. Bob, let me ask you this. We're about out of time. Website we can find you at.
You can find me at bobbaer.com, B-O-B-B-A-R-E.
Hey, Bob Baer, hey, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Okay, thank you for having me on.
Take care, good night.
Okay.
You be brave, young lovers, and follow your star. Brave and faithful and true. And cling very close to each other tonight. I've been in love like you. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You fly down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet, not by chance. Don't cry, young lovers, whatever you do. Say don't cry because I'm alone. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I have had a love of my own. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You wing down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet, not by chance. Don't cry, young lovers, whatever you do. Say don't cry because I'm alone. All of my memories are happy tonight. I have had a love of my own. Hallelujah! I've had a love of my own like yours. I have had a love of my own. Ah.
Yes, welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought-Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. After Somewhere, oh, she's back. Kathy Puckett is here, co-author of Homeland Insecurity. Kathy, welcome back. Hello, Kathy. Did we lose
Are
Kathy?
You there?
Oh, we're here. Are you there?
You know, I'm here.
They're after us, Kath. They're after us.
They're after us? They're after us?
Have you got the tinfoil on so the White House doesn't hear us? Hey, I got a
Very good.
I got a subject ready for tonight. We're going to talk about drugs, all right? Which is the best drug to take that will numb you from everything that's going on politically in the last week or so?
Oh, with the terrible storms. You know, I understand that was, I guess it's as bad a tornado as you can get hit Missouri.
Yeah, no, at Joplin. Now, absolutely, there's something like 100-some-odd deaths. So one of them I was sitting there listening to. I teared up. I couldn't listen to it anymore. It was a man, the son, that the kid was pulled out through the sunroof of the car. What do you say? I don't even know what to say. My heart goes out to them, and my goodness, if there's anything anybody can do to help them, I think we should be standing right there.
Yeah,
isn't that what an American is supposed to be?
Yeah, and I've heard they have a lot of volunteers on site there.
Now, by the way, speaking of drugs, there's a lot of stuff that came up about, like this segue, about the Tylenol, the Unabomber, Kaczynski.
Oh, yes. Well, let me tell you what really happened there, Michael. Now, I understand that, first ask me, say what you heard about this.
Oh, basically what I heard, there was some DNA, something that came up, and they tied Kaczynski to the Tylenol, the Tylenol that had been tarnished, and there were people who actually died from it.
Well, yeah, there, in 1982, there were 7 deaths, actually, from cyanide-laced Tylenol in the Chicago area. It was very, very, still an unsolved case. And let me tell you what really happened, because what you just said, Michael, is what everybody's heard,
yes,
that the FBI linked Theodore Kaczynski, the Unabomber, who's in the Supermax prison in Florence, Colorado, for life, to the Tylenol murders. But what really happened is this. I don't exactly know why a couple of years ago. This case is still open. It's still an open federal case, and I'm sure that there are open local jurisdiction cases on the Tylenol deaths, because locally there would never be an expiration or a limitation on charging murder in a murder case locally, and federally there is no expiration either. So that case is open. It's been open ever since 1982. There have been multiple suspects, have been eliminated all over the years. And for some reason, someone who got the case, probably a brand new, spanking new FBI agent, probably in the Chicago division, or some other office that needed to demonstrate work on this case and who might genuinely want to make progress on the case, decided to get DNA samples from known felons who were at large in those years, who might have some connection, and who were serial killers themselves. So Kaczynski was one of those. And he and or she went to the Supermax in Florence, Colorado, and asked to see Mr. Kaczynski and asked him for his DNA sample. And Ted Kaczynski said, reportedly, "I will only give you a DNA sample if you stop the auction of my property that the court has ordered to happen." And, of course, they weren't going to do that, so that's how that happened. Now, why this surfaced lately is because the media heard about and researched the court ruling on Kaczynski's motion for a stay. He essentially made a he's learned the whole legal system, Michael, while he's been in prison. I mean, the guy is a genius. And basically, he wrote a motion to the court saying, "How can you proceed with auctioning off items from my cabin, which I had in 1982, if they might be related to some crime, if I'm a suspect in this case, in the Tylenol murder case?" And so that's why it surfaced, through media looking at the court documents.
Okay, so in essence, it's really somebody jumped on it because it looked like something that could have happened because of Kaczynski's actions.
He was
negotiating with them, and they weren't going to negotiate. Somebody picked it up, and now all of a sudden it was him because he won't say anything.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. You know, he was also, there were also people who were convinced that he was also the Zodiac killer.
Yeah.
In the 60s in San Francisco. So, because he was, of course, in Berkeley in the late 60s. But, you know, that, interestingly, from my point of view, you know, behaviorally, there's very little that connects either any of those three serial crime entities. The Zodiac killer, of course, was also never caught, and neither was the Tylenol killer. But, of course, the Unabomber was eventually caught, and Terry Turchi and I, my business partner, former deputy assistant director for counterterrorism at the FBI, and I were in Atlanta last week to open the press conference to open the auction of the Unabomber's items that's been pending for all these years.
Wow, what an interesting place to be! You know, when you think about it,
interesting, Michael, to see it 15 years after I first saw these things in the cabin. You know, after he was arrested, and before we found the live bomb under his bed, I saw everything the way it was in the cabin, the way he lived in his cabin, and now to see them 15 years later kind of displayed. There's not one item of all the lots. They divide them into lots according to categories. I think there are something like 70 lots, and I don't know how many total items, but not one single lot was left alone and not bid on. The bidding is already up to about $100,000, and it's only been a few days. And funny enough, I think what's going to happen, and this is what auctioneers are saying, that probably the real bidders, the people who are going to be coming in with real bids, are not going to come in until the last day or two. The sale ends, it's an online auction, and it ends on June 2nd.
Let me, Kathy, ask you this. Why would somebody want to buy that?
Exactly. That's what everybody's been saying. Do you know who I talked to today, Michael, about that?
No.
David Kaczynski.
Oh, okay.
David Kaczynski is a friend of mine. He's the guy that I, you know, he is Ted Kaczynski's brother. Yeah. We talked for an hour and a half today about the strange week we both had last week. Because he wants the victims to, receive what the court gave them. But he said, who is it? Who, this murderabilia, who would want these things?
Yeah.
And, you know, basically there are just a lot of people who are extremely fascinated with aberrant characters, and I mean, people collect Nazi memorabilia.
Oh, I remember when I was in Fairbanks, there was a friend of mine who was very much into guns, and I will never forget this. We walked into his house one day. Well, I walked into the house one day, and we were talking about he collected guns, and I've been a gun guy forever, but nothing like what
sure.
I was going to see. So we're standing there, and the wall goes back, right? And we walk in. He collected Nazi memorabilia. He had machine gun. He had a license. I mean, everything was legal. But he had machine guns in there, and he had every kind of a whatever you can imagine that were in pistols and rifles and everything that the Nazis used. And he even had a statue in there with somebody with the uniform. Being Jewish, I got to tell you, that was a very interesting place to be.
I was not
comfortable in there. But there are people who just do that. He must have had $500,000 worth of guns in there. And it was all legal. It was all legal. But
yeah,
it was an interesting thing.
It's just amazing to me. It's kind of like you can see people have collected war. You know, there are people who collect Civil War items and things. You know, it's funny, Michael. Terry and I actually were asked by the victim families in the Unabom case to just this year to act on their behalf and go to Atlanta on their behalf and deal with this auction so that they would not have to be present. And we were glad to do that for them. And when we were traveling out there, essentially we were kind of wondering, well, you know, what are we going to ask? I mean, they wanted us to put values on the items, you know, initial offering auction value. And I had no idea how to do that. And I said, well, we're not qualified to do that. And I ended up calling some appraisers from the Antiques Roadshow. But
with your background, you'd have to figure out where to go, who to call. I know, you got it.
Yeah, and so what we ended up doing is not putting any prices on them. It's just kind of what the market will bear. And of course, at this point, the item that has the largest amount that's been bid on it is the gray hooded sweatshirt and sunglasses, and it's over $20,000.
Wow!
Somebody's already bid. I mean, that's amazing.
I mean, that's all I can say is wow. I can't fathom that in my heart of hearts. Fathom that. But if that's what somebody wants, that's what they get. We've got
where would he put it? I mean, what would you do with something like that?
Tell them.
You know, put it on a mannequin and I just don't know what you would do with that. You know, like here is what this man wore when he put a bomb down that, you know, seriously injured the owner of the store that he, sure. it was, and that was a particularly nasty bomb. It was luckily the owner of that store tripped on his way to pick it up. It looked like a piece of road debris, and so it detonated away from him. So he lived, but an identical bomb 2 years earlier killed another store owner.
Oh, sure. Now, somebody was looking after the store owner. Let me move to a different subject matter. We've got about 5 minutes to go.
Sure.
Your take on Barack Obama's speech as regards to Israel giving up the borders to the 1967 border. What did you experience with that?
Well, I thought that it's probably the first time in a long time that I see pros and cons with it overall. But what I did see was the first time that there's been any kind of movement in the administration where what I got out of it was not that the boundaries would go back or that he had any idea or a thought or a belief that they should. The boundaries, Israel's boundaries, go back to 1967. They were indefensible boundaries at the time, just like Benjamin Netanyahu has said. There's no way that we can defend our borders if we went to the 1967 border.
Sure. You get 8 miles wide and that's it.
But what I really think was interesting was that what the president actually said was, there has to be a starting point. We have to start somewhere, and everywhere we've started for all these many years has never been where we needed to start. Let's start at a different point. Let's just start there. And I think the result, you saw the result today in Mr. Netanyahu's speech, he's going to receive a lot of criticism at home from the conservatives in his party and in his government for what he said. But he was put in a position where if he didn't, I really think it was kind of a stroke of genius.
Now, let me tell you what I heard in that. If I was a negotiator, all right,
mm-hmm.
if I was a negotiator, I wouldn't give away my my negotiating that piece that I have to negotiate with before you got to the tables.
You
give
mean
it
the
away.
1967
Yeah, what do you
boundary?
Have to negotiate with? Yeah, if you give it away in front, what do you have to negotiate with?
So but that's the genius of it. He didn't give it away. He said that the boundaries themselves were not important, but they could be used as a starting place. They haven't been, that has not even been on the table, Michael, for decades.
Yeah, but the point would be is this, you negotiate for that. You don't give this up and then negotiate. You've got no strength.
I suspect, Michael, that they've been negotiating for that 4 years, and it's never gone anywhere.
Yeah, but each time it happens, you got Hamas, you got somebody sabotaging it, and it's not the Palestinians, and it's not the Israelis.
Well, I do think that Netanyahu was right when he said that. He is prepared to make concessions for peace, but Hamas, which is an avowed enemy of Israel and stated policy that Israel as a state should no longer exist and they should kill everybody, there's no negotiation with them.
Yeah, and so, Hamas is not the Palestinians.
No.
And I think that's
a
lot of people don't realize. The Palestinians,
right.
they're not what we see. They're not the terrorists, quote unquote. It's Hamas.
Right, exactly.
Yeah. And exactly. Radio Susie has been blaming you for a week.
Blaming me for a week that you were so upset about this?
No, that the negotiations haven't taken place. You got to blame somebody. I mean, this is
okay.
The world we live in.
Well, I was in Atlanta.
She was in Atlanta. It was okay. Yeah, she said, yeah, sure. Okay. All right, we're about out of time. Let me ask you this. If you could sit down at that table and you became the mediator, what would you do to create something that could at least give it balance on both sides? What would you do to do that?
What would I do? I tell you what I would do. The thing that popped into my head when you said, what would you do? I would say, where's Hillary Clinton? Because that's who needs to be sitting here, not me.
But right now we're going to make you, we're going to make you the be-all, do-all. The magic wand is yours. You have the power. If you
I don't have enough knowledge. I don't have the knowledge.
By the way, you say something very good. Wait, let me say something very good. You've seen Herman Cain, right?
Yes.
Okay, I love an answer that he gave the other night. He was being interviewed by Chris Wallace. And Wallace said, what would you do if you were president about Afghanistan? And he looked at Wallace and basically said, I don't know. I would have to get all of my information from the CIA, from this one, from that one. How could I make a decision without knowing everything first? And I stood up and I applauded him. I thought the answer was brilliant. And it was
I was brilliant too, Michael?
Yes.
Thank you.
Yes. Yes. No, I think, we go through life and people are giving all these great opinions and saying this and that without the knowledge of what goes underneath it. So I'm voting for you and Cain. You be the vice president.
Okay, great. I like hearing that.
Okay, we're just about out of time. The website we can find you at?
HomelandInsecurityTheBlog.com, Michael.
Wonderful. And we will see you next week?
Next week, Michael.
You got it. I'll be right here. I'm waiting.
Looking forward to it. Bye-bye.
Good night.
Making a crazy ding-dong.
And if this band don't desert us,
then there's nothing in the world can hurt us. Long as we're singing our song.
Give me trumpets, legato.
Put some saxes with them.
Strings, pizzicato.
Add some rhythm. As long as we're singing, then the world's all right and everything's swinging. Long as we're singing out. Long as we're singing out. Long as we're singing.
I'm Michael Ray Dresser, and you are listening to Thought-Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Pamela McQuaid with us. She is an author. She's a speaker. She's a master healer devoted to the mission of bringing spirituality into the mainstream. She's appeared nationwide on TV, radio, sharing her wisdom and helping people raise their consciousness and discover their inner beauty. She's a Reiki master, spiritual coach, and leads spiritual spa healing retreats. And her book is Spirituality, Rich and Sexy, A Woman's Guide to Becoming Infinitely Attractive. And let's say hi, Pamela, welcome to the show.
Hey, Michael, thank you. How are you?
Oh, I am good, and thank you for being here. By the way, what is attractive? Can we actually define that word?
Well, you know, I think that means something different to everyone, but in my world, attractive is about inner beauty.
Yes. See, and attractive is not what you see on the outside. I think attractive is what you see from the inside out. Somebody that I guess it was about a week ago, I got into this with somebody on the air, and it was a woman, and I know the woman personally, and I said, I think you're absolutely beautiful. And I said, but I think Lady Gaga is ugly. And she kind of stepped back and she thought, well, she's a gorgeous young woman. It's what's inside. You know, now this is for me. This is not for everybody else. And nobody has to think the way I think. This is how I think. Because when I looked at her and when I saw Gaga doing what she did, I didn't see beauty. So the attractiveness comes from inside out, because you people, if they look at you, they can see inside of you on the outside of you.
Absolutely. And you know, that's a big part of my message. In fact, I tell the story a lot, how, you know, in high school, you know, here I was. I mean, I've always been an attractive person on the outside. And, you know, it was like I had some high school friends connect with me on Facebook. And they made a comment. I mean, I had this going on, like several people saying to me, you know, Pam, you're always cute, you know, in high school, but, you know, you really look fabulous. And I said, you know, it kind of synced up with me. And I said, you know what? I'm 43 years old, and it's the first time in my life I've really felt beautiful. Because back in high school and the college days, I was a train wreck emotionally and spiritually. And so even though my outer part, and that's a big part of my book, is how society holds people to the yardstick of vanity. You know, if you don't look a certain way, you're not thin, you don't have a luxury car or live in the right neighborhood or whatever it is, society would tell us that that's not attractive. And you know what? It's just the opposite. When you transform the inside of yourself, your belief systems, your emotions, your perceptions about yourself, that's when the light starts really radiating and people become truly beautiful. It's that glow.
And when you don't have to prove it anymore. Here, let's do this. I love this example. God asked me if I'm good looking. Go ahead.
Oh, God asked me if I were good looking, and no, I looked within and said, I'm beautiful. I'm spiritually rich and sexy.
Wait, Pamela, ask me if I'm good looking. Go ahead, ask me.
Are you good looking, Michael?
Funny you should ask that question. Absolutely, and if you don't think so, somebody else will. And I
think, yeah, that's right.
That's really
because
what
like
about.
Attracts like at an energetic level.
If I had five women standing in front of me right now, and if I had the ability, Pamela, to walk behind each one and look through their eyes and see me, I would see somebody, maybe somebody, one of them would be absolutely gorgeous to somebody else. I'd be the worst thing that ever, the worst disaster that ever happened. You can't please everybody. So be who you are and be the best of who you are.
Absolutely. I love that. That's so true. You know, I always said, it dawned on me about a year or two ago that I had the disease to please. And thank heavens that is no longer, because, yeah, you know, that opens up freedom, true freedom. And so that's a huge part of what I speak about is becoming free.
Oh, and by the way, it's free of the fear of judgment. And that's what
yes, of fears, of doubts, right? Of any kind. It's total freedom at really a holistic, a body, mind, soul level. Absolutely.
See, you and I meet, and I'm not going to be who I am. I'm going to be who I think you want me to be. There's where the problems start, that first lie. And you're not doing it intentionally, and you're not doing it to hurt anybody. But as you move through and the closer you get, now all of a sudden I'm starting to become who I am because it's a little safer for me to come out. And the more I become who I am, the more you look at me and say, I don't know you. You're not the person.
Well, and, you know, as energy attracts, also it's true that the people that you attract around you are like-minded in the sense of energetic. So oftentimes you're looking at another and you use the word judgment. So so often people judge, and what they don't realize is that they're judging themselves.
Oh, it's projection.
When you're
totally
looking at another person, it's what you're seeing within yourself. So anytime you're talking and you're pointing a finger and saying something about someone, it's always a message that you need yourself.
Absolutely. Mirror, mirror on the wall.
Right.
Yeah, and we're so self-centered, and that's not a bad thing. It's just what it is. We're so self-centered, and it's about us. If I like something in me, I'm going to find it in you. If I don't like something in me, I'm going to see it in you, and then I get to blame you because it can't be me. It's got to be you.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, that within itself is a huge revelation for some people. You know, that was really my beginning experience when I really started recognizing, you know, my life has been through, you know, such adversity in the past. And one day I really kind of had that moment and I recognized that something about this, I kept saying in my mind, I'm the common denominator. And at that point, I didn't know how I was. I just knew that all of a sudden, you know, the perception of, you know, oh, poor me, the victim Pamela, started realizing none of that was ever true, that somehow I was attracting and causing this. And that really opened up my search within, where I knew I had to fix something within myself to change my circumstances.
And really, when it comes down to it, what I've found over the years, that if somebody is beating someone up, they're not really beating, I don't mean physically, but they're not really beating someone up. What they're doing is they're pushing that person away from them to prove that they're not worthy of having them. So if I beat you up, I'm not hurting you. I probably am, but I'm not hurting you. I'm beating myself up through you.
Right. And that's a very, you know, deep sort of analogy, but real truth behind that, because that's always the case. Again, it's about, you know, consciousness level is really key, because, you know, when you're at a certain level of consciousness, it's like radio frequencies. You know, everyone's at a different frequency. And if I'm at a certain level and someone is talking to me, literally you can't hear them if they're not at the same frequency. So oftentimes when you get into these vibrations that are, you know, more of a negative type of frequency, that's what's happening, is the perception that it could possibly be me doesn't even resonate. I mean, there's no truth to that at all. And that's where raising the consciousness becomes really key, to really reach within and really, and there are more things than just alternative healing. I mean, you can, you know, if you have at all a sense of that you really want to change your life and your experiences, that's when the opening starts, even if it's just a small thing about, gosh, you know, maybe I could start meditating or praying or, you know, looking at things in a different way in terms of being grateful for what I do have. I mean, there's so many little keys that can open up such a huge doorway in your life.
You know, you said something about the, I'll say it in a different way, but like attracts like. And it's very interesting when somebody is miserable, they're depressed all the time, and they have certain friends, and they get on the phone and they talk about their troubles and their trials and their pain together. And then when that one person starts to feel better, they start to lose their friends because now they have nothing in common. And they get that period of time where they feel alone until they start attracting that those other people on that next level, and now they've got something in common. But what happens, they drift away, and all of a sudden, I'm out there and I'm by myself. I don't have
that's
anything
to be expected. In fact, it's funny. Yeah. I write about that very thing in my book, that's not only okay, that's great. That's exactly what you want to have happening. And, you know, change oftentimes when I'm coaching clients, it's so, you know, people hold fear around change. And the thing is, change is so good because that shows that you're actually taking the step up in consciousness when everything around you starts shifting. I mean, it's like, hooray, let's celebrate. This is a great thing. But oftentimes, you know, big things start happening that appear not so good, meaning that's a lot of times when people end relationships, or, you know, a job, they get fired from a job, or something that appears really traumatic is actually a great thing because it's leading them towards, you know, more towards their purpose or what they're really here to do, or more happiness or joy or that sort of thing.
No, by the way, there's a very important word, and that word is called recognize. And most people go through life, they don't recognize certain things. And they like, here, for instance, Fear can be a wonderful thing, because you just said it a moment ago that you start to change, you become afraid. Well, if you recognize what the fear is about, then all of a sudden this is a gift to you, because if I wasn't ready to change, I wouldn't be afraid. Then the moment that you get that, the fear goes.
Yes, absolutely. And again, that's about shifting the consciousness, because all of a sudden it's akin to putting rose-colored glasses on and really taking a look at your life and saying, wow, you know, I went through all this stuff, and it really was very hurtful and painful and all of this, and yet, like, I mean, that's my story. When you completely transform your life, I look back now, and everything is so perfect, it's really awe-inspiring. I look back and go, I would have done that all over again, because I could have never arrived at this place of peace, happiness, joy, prosperity, had I not experienced all of that.
By the way, there was somebody that I know who was told no. She was a particular kind of an athlete. And the coach says, that's not you. You're not going to do it. You don't have what it takes. She wouldn't accept no, so she found another coach. And between she and this coach, she achieved her goal. She ended up marrying the coach that she met. You know, now this is 20, 30 years ago that this happened. And my contention was that first guy who said no, I would send him flowers, because if it wasn't for him, she wouldn't have met her husband. She wouldn't have had the life she has, and many, many things that wouldn't have happened. So those things that we think are horrible and that we don't want to face are the best things that could ever happen to us.
You know, that's so true. And the piece that's really key about that phrase is forgiveness. Because, you know, part of what I didn't say when I just said that is now I look back at people like my ex-husband and, you know, different experiences that were very traumatic. And not only have I come through forgiveness of that, I've come to a place of there's nothing even to forgive. I mean, I am just like bow on my knees because that was a perfect experience for me at that time. So forgiveness within people, it can, you know, that's such a tricky thing because, you know, when you have really hard things happen, it's like there's that bitterness. But I tell you, forgiveness is always about yourself. It's never about the other person. And it can really poison your system and make you be bitter. And that is really counterpart to raising your consciousness and really moving on to higher levels of happiness and those sorts of things. So if I tell anyone anything, it's forgive first. That's one of the most freeing things you can do in your life.
Well, how about thank you?
Exactly. Forgive me. Thank you. I love you. Exactly.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you for destroying me. But guess what I'm going to do next? That's very hard to do at the time. And it's very hard for a person going through it at that moment, challenges, pain, and so on and so forth. Mm-hmm. But there is always a light at the end of the tunnel. My best example of that, and if I repeat it a million times, I thank Sylvester Stallone for this. In his last Rocky movie, he was having some problems with his kid because the kid thought he was overshadowing him. And he said to him, life, and Rocky said to his son, life is tough. It's going to grind you down. It's the worst thing that can ever happen. But he said, it's not how hard you hit that says how tough you are. It's how hard you can get hit and get up and keep moving. And that's really what it's all about. You're going to get hit. Don't lay mm-hmm. down.
It's
get
such up. A well. You know, the hit is the piece that oftentimes it's what starts awakening you to a different level of thinking. And that's oftentimes when people start searching and going, you know, what have I really come for? And, you know, it really, you hate to say, you know, gosh, it's, you know, all that pain and struggle and limitation. But I tell you, it's those very things that start helping you understand what your own energetic blocks, fears, doubts, you know, where are you standing in terms of your belief systems, that type of stuff starts entering, just begging for freedom.
Pamela, what gets us into trouble is what we don't know, and the next step is what we don't know that what we don't know. Most people are frightened to death of the unknown, i.e., better be unhappy than unsure. And one of the mm-hmm. ways that you can move through that is you project yourself 20, 25 years ahead, and you imagine that there is this party, and they're honoring you at the party, and then you write down all of the things that you want them to say about you. Now you've got 20 years to become that.
Mm-hmm. That is so great, because what you're explaining there is really one of the keys to manifestation. It's really about visualizing the end result and giving up the how, the who, the where, and the why it's going to happen.
Yeah, just let it just
and
let
it's,
it happen.
It's about the emotion behind it. You know, when you're visualizing that end party, it's about a feeling. It's about feeling joyful and happy and at peace. And that's just really key. Yeah, I love that. That's a great way of saying, you know, here's manifestation at the best. All you have to do is simply imagine the end result, let go of the hows, and follow your guidance, and you're going to arrive.
And now you've got something to look forward to. You've got a goal to shoot for. And most people don't know where they're going to go, don't know where they're going to end up and what their purpose is and so on and so forth. Everybody's purpose is not standing on a hill wearing a robe and being spiritual. It's inside. Everybody's purpose is their own particular purpose in the life that they have, and there's a reason for it. And if your legacy is to give someone the gift of being able to foresee something before it happens, giving them your experience so they don't have the problem, then you've done the job. And that's powerful in and of itself.
Mm-hmm. It really is. And, you know, one time, you know, I really had one of these thoughts that came to me, and it said, what if we told you everything that you've ever learned was wrong? And it kind of stunned me. And I was like, you know, I had to sit with that for a minute. And then I heard, what if we told you everything you need to know is already within yourself? And that actually spurred one of the best articles I've ever written about going in reverse. And what happened to me within that time period was I started recognizing that everything in my life, and especially this whole book writing process, I went about everything the complete opposite of what you're told to do by the marketing experts.
Yeah.
And you know what? I have had incredible miracles happen. And I knew in that moment that I had done it right. My right way and what's going to make me successful isn't the right way for you. We all have our own keys.
Well,
and you have to really get in touch with your inner self so that you can be led down the easiest, surest, most successful path. Because when I coach people, oftentimes I'll say, well, you know, even at some level, everybody gets those gut feelings. And I always say, have you ever had a gut feeling about something you didn't act on? Has it ever turned out in a positive light for you? It never does. If you go against what you're guided to do, it's not going to work out. I mean, that's your own inner system, your higher self coming and saying, you know, this is the direction, not this. Even if it is against everything you know to be true. That's been pretty much the representation of my life. So I tell people, don't listen to anything. You know, don't take my word for it. Don't take any word. Continue to question who you are and what you believe and follow that.
When someone says everything that you know and everything that you've learned in your life is wrong, you got to define what wrong is, because it's wrong for where you should be at, and that's where the shift happens to that has to take place. Pamela, we're starting to get out of time here.
Okay.
Do you have a website we can find you at?
Oh, yes. My website is spiritualityissexy.com, and my new book, Spiritually Rich and Sexy, A Woman's Guide to Becoming Infinitely Attractive, is on that website, and you know, you can go to Amazon and Barnes & Noble and find it as well.
Very quickly, if The Woman's Guide to Becoming Infinitely Attractive, as a man, could I go in, read the same thing, take the same road, and become infinitely attractive?
Yes, it's the same. And what's really funny, a lot of the reviews that have come in are all from men. I mean, I've had women, of course, too, but I've had so many men go, I love this book. And I even had a guy say to me one time, not only if I didn't understand women before I read the book, I certainly understand them now. But yes, the principles in the book are for everyone. And I've actually kind of been shocked that, yeah, men are reading it and going, I love this. This is great. So... Yeah, that's very exciting. A new, fresh twist.
Okay, we got to go. Thank you so much for being here.
Thanks, Michael. I appreciate it.
Take care. Good night.
Good night.
That's all there is. There isn't any more. We'll share the moment. And as the moment ends, I got a funny feeling we're parting out as friends.
I'm Michael Ray Dresser, and that, my friends, is a wrap.
Tears and laughter will linger after they've torn down these dusty walls. If I had this to do again, and the evening were new again, I would spend it with you. But now the curtain falls.